Dawn of Flame by Stanley G. Weinbaum. Chapter 2. Old Einar. 3 weeks in Saluik had served to give Hall Tarvish a sort of speaking acquaintancy with the place. He no longer gaped at the sky-piercing ruins of the ancient city or the vast fallen bridges, and he was quite at home in the town that lay beside it. He had found work easily enough in a baker's establishment, where his great muscles served well. The hours were long, but his pay was munificent. 5 silver quarters a week. He paid 2 for lodging and food. What he needed beyond the burnt loaves at hand from his employment cost him another quarter. But that left 2 to put by. And he never gambled other than a wager now and then on his own marksmanship, and that was more profitable than otherwise. Ordinarily, Hall was quick to make friends, but his long hours hindered him. He had but one, an incredibly old man who sat at evening on the step beyond his lodging, old Einar. So this evening Hall wandered out as usual to join him, staring at the crumbling towers of the ancients glowing in the sunset. Trees sprung on many, and all were green with vine and tussock and the growth of wind-carried seeds. No one dared build among the ruins, for none could guess when a great tower might come crashing down. "I wonder," he said to old Einar, "what the ancients were like. Were they men like us? Then how could they fly?" "They were men like us, Hall. As for flying, well, it's my belief that flying is a legend. See here. There was a man supposed to have flown over the cold lands to the north and those to the south, and also across the great sea. But this flying man is called in some accounts Lindbird, and in others Bird, and surely one can see the origin of such a legend. The migrations of birds, who cross land and seas each year, that is all." "Or perhaps magic," suggested Hall. "There is no magic. The ancients themselves denied it, and I have struggled through many a moldy book in a curious, archaic tongue." Old Einar was the first scholar Hall had ever encountered. Though there were many during the dawn of that brilliant age called the Second Enlightenment, most of them were still within the Empire. John Holland was dead, but Olin was still alive in the world, and Kolmar, and Jorgensen, and Teron, and Martin Serre, and Joaquin Smith, the master. Great names. The names of demigods. But Hall knew little of them. "You can read," he exclaimed. "That in itself is a sort of magic. And you have been within the Empire, even in New Orleans. Tell me, what is the great city like? Have they really learned the secrets of the ancients? Are the immortals truly immortal? How did they gain their knowledge?" Old Einar settled himself on the step and puffed blue smoke from his pipe filled with the harsh tobacco of the region. "Too many questions breed answers to none," he observed. "Shall I tell you the true story of the world, Hall? The story called history?" "Yes, in Ozarky we spoke little of such things." "Well," said the old man comfortably, "I will begin then at what to us is the beginning, but to the ancients was the end. I do not know what factors, what wars, what struggles led up to the mighty world that died during the dark centuries, but I do know that 300 years ago the world reached its climax. You cannot imagine such a place, Hall. It was a time of vast cities, too, 50 times as large as New Orleans, with its 100,000 people." He puffed slowly. "Great steel wagons roared over the iron roads of the ancients. Men crossed the oceans to east and west. The cities were full of whirring wheels, and instead of the many little city-states of our time, there were giant nations. Thousands of cities and 100 million, 150 million people." Hall stared. "I do not believe there are so many people in the world," he said. Old Einar shrugged. "Who knows?" he returned. "The ancient books, all too few, tell us that the world is round, and that beyond the seas lie one or several continents. But what races are there today? Not even Joaquin Smith can say." He puffed smoke again. "Well, such was the ancient world. These were warlike nations, so fond of battle that they had to write many books about the horrors of war to keep themselves at peace. But they always failed. During the time they called their 20th century, there was a whole series of wars. Not such little quarrels as we have so often between our city-states, nor even such as that between the Memphis League and the Empire 5 years ago. Their wars spread like storm clouds around the world, and were fought between millions of men with unimaginable weapons that flung destruction 100 miles, and with ships on the sea, and with gases." "What's gases?" asked Hall. Old Einar waved his hand so that the wind of it brushed the youth's brown cheek. "Air is a gas," he said. "They knew how to poison the air so that all who breathed it died. And they fought with diseases. And legend says that they fought also in the air with wings. But that is only legend."
"Diseases," said Hall. "Diseases are the breath of devils. And if they controlled devils, they used sorcery. And therefore, they knew magic."
"There is no magic," reiterated the old man. "I do not know how they fought each other with diseases, but Martin Serres of New Orleans knows. That was his study, not mine. But I know there was no magic in it."
He resumed his tale.
"So these great fierce nations flung themselves against each other, for war meant more to them than to us. With us it is something of a rough, joyous, dangerous game. But to them it was a passion. They fought for any reason, or none at all save the love of fighting."
"Now, I love fighting," said Hall.
"Yes, but would you love it if it meant simply the destroying of thousands of men beyond the horizon? Men you were never to see?"
"No. War should be man to man, or at least no farther than the carry of a rifle ball."
"True. Well, sometime near the end of their 20th century, the ancient world exploded into war like a powder horn in a fire. They say every nation fought, and battles surged back and forth across seas and continents. It was not only nation against nation, but race against race, black and white and yellow and red, all embroiled in a titanic struggle."
"Yellow and red?" echoed Hall. "There are a few black men called Nigs in Ozarky, but I never heard of yellow or red men."
"I have seen yellow men," said old Einar. "There are some towns of yellow men on the edge of the Western Ocean, in the region called Frisica. The red race, they say, is gone, wiped out by the plague called the Grey Death, to which they yielded more readily than the other races."
"Now, I've heard of the Grey Death," said Hall. "When I was very young, there was an old, old man who used to say that his grandfather had lived in the days of the Death."
Old Einar smiled.
"I doubt it, Hall. It was something over 2.5 centuries ago." "However," he resumed, "the great ancient nations were at war, and as I say, they fought with diseases. Whether some nation learned the secret of the Grey Death, or whether it grew up as a sort of cross between two or more other diseases, I do not know. Martin Serres says that diseases are living things, so it may be so. At any rate, the Grey Death leaped suddenly across the world, striking alike at all people. Everywhere it blasted the armies, the cities, the countryside, and of those it struck, 6 out of every 10 died. There must have been chaos in the world.
We have not a single book printed during that time, and only legend tells the story. But the war collapsed. Armies suddenly found themselves unopposed, and then were blasted before they could move. Ships in mid-ocean were stricken, and drifted unmanned to pile in wreckage, or to destroy others. In the cities, the dead were piled in the streets, and after a while were simply left where they fell, while those who survived fled away into the country. What remained of the armies became little better than roving robber bands, and by the third year of the plague there were few, if any, stable governments in the world.
What stopped it? Asked Hall.
I do not know. They end these pestilences. Those who take it and live cannot take it a second time, and those who are somehow immune do not take it at all, and the rest die. The Great Death swept the world for 3 years. When it ended, according to Martin Sayre, 1 person in 4 had died. But the plague came back in lessening waves for many years. Only a pestilence in the ancient 14th century, called the Black Death, seems ever to have equaled it. Yet its effects were only beginning. The ancient transport system had simply collapsed, and the cities were starving. Hungry gangs began raiding the countryside, and instead of one vast war, there were now 1,000,000 little battles. The weapons of the ancients were everywhere, and those battles were fierce enough in all truth, though nothing like the colossal encounters of the Great War. Year by year, the cities decayed, until by the 50th year after the Great Death, the world's population had fallen by 3/4, and civilization was ended. It was barbarism now that ruled the world, but only barbarism, not savagery. People still remembered the mighty ancient civilization, and everywhere there were attempts to combine into the old nations. But these failed, for lack of great leaders.
As they should fail, said Hall. We have freedom now.
Perhaps. By the 1st century after the plague, there was little left of the ancients, save their ruined cities where lurked robber bands that scoured the country by night. They had little interest in anything save food or the coined money of the old nations, and they did incalculable damage. Few could read, and on cold nights it was usual to raid the ancient libraries for books to burn. And to make things worse, fire gutted the ruins of all cities, and there was no organized resistance to it. The flames simply burned themselves out, and priceless books vanished.
Yet in New Orleans they study, don't they? Asked Hall.
Yes, I'm coming to that. About 2 centuries after the plague, 100 years ago, that is, the world had stabilized itself. It was much as it is here today, with little farming towns and vast stretches of deserted country. Gunpowder had been rediscovered, rifles were used, and most of the robber bands had been destroyed. And then, into the town in New Orleans, built beside the ancient city, came young John Holland. Holland was a rare specimen, anxious for learning. He found the remains of an ancient library, and began slowly to decipher from the archaic words from the few books that had survived. Little by little, others joined him, and as the word spread slowly, men from other sections wandered in with books, and the academy was born. No one taught, of course. It was just a group of studious men living a sort of communistic, monastic life. There was no attempt at practical use of the ancient knowledge until a youth named Terron had a dream. No less a dream than to recondition the centuries-old power machines of New Orleans to give the city the power that travels on wires.
"What's that?" asked Hall.
"What's that, old Einar?"
"You wouldn't understand, Hall.
Terron was an enthusiast. It didn't stop him to realize there was no coal or oil to run his machines.
He believed that when power was needed, it would be there. So he and his followers scrubbed and filed and welded away, and Terron was right. When he needed power, it was there. This was the gift of a man named Olin, who had unearthed the last, the crowning secret of the ancients, the power called atomic energy. He gave it to Terron, and Norlands became a miracle city where lights glowed and wheels turned. Men came from every part of the continent to see, and among these were two called Martin Sayre and Joaquin Smith, come out of Mexico with the half-sister of Joaquin, the satanically beautiful being, sometimes called Black Margot. Martin Sayre was a genius. He found his field in the study of medicine, and it was less than 10 years before he had uncovered the secret of the hard rays. He was studying sterility, but he found immortality. "Then the immortals are immortal," murmured Hall. "It may be, Hall. At least they do not seem to age, but..." "Well, Joaquin Smith was also a genius, but of a different sort. He dreamed of the reuniting of the peoples of the country. I think he dreams of even more, Hall. People say he will stop when he rules 100 cities, but I think he dreams of an American empire, or..." Old Einar's voice dropped. "A world empire. At least he took Martin Sayre's immortality and traded it for power. The Second Enlightenment was dawning, and there was genius in Norlands. He traded immortality to Colmar for a weapon. He offered it to Olin for atomic power. But Olin was already past youth and refused, partly because he didn't want it, and partly because he was not entirely in sympathy with Joaquin Smith. So the Master seized the secret of the atom despite Olin, and the conquest began. Norlands, directly under the influence of the Master's magnetic personality, was ready to yield, and yielded to him cheering. He raised his army and marched north, and everywhere cities fell or yielded willingly. Joaquin Smith is magnificent, and men flock to him. Cities cheer him. Even the wives and children of the slain swear allegiance when he forgives them in that noble manner of his. Only here and there, men hate him bitterly, and speak such words as tyrant and talk of freedom. Such are the mountainies, said Hall. Not even the mountainies can stand the ionic beams that Colmar dug out of ancient books, nor the Erden resonator that explodes gunpowder miles away. I think that Joaquin Smith will succeed, Hall. Moreover, I do not think it entirely bad that he should, for he is a great ruler and a bringer of civilization.
What do they like, the immortals?
Well, Martin Sayre is as cold as mountain rock, and the Princess Margaret is like black fire. Even my old bones feel younger, only to look at her. And it is wise for young men not to look at her at all, because she is quite heartless, ruthless, and pitiless. As for Joaquin Smith, the Master, I do not know the words to describe so complex a character, and I know him well. He is mild, perhaps, but enormously strong, kind or cruel, as suits his purpose, glitteringly intelligent, and dangerously charming.
You know him?
Echoed Hall, and added curiously,
What is your other name, old Einar? You who know the immortals.
The old man smiled. When I was born, he said, my parents called me Einar Olin. End of chapter 2.